Y la noche también, ya llegaba la hora en la noche, tenía que dejar esa ropa limpia, entonces tenía que hacer trabajo extra después de mi trabajo. Eso era lo único que hacía además.
But also I had to work, wake up very early to prepare what they needed for the day, prepare their everything that they would need. And then when I got home at night, I would have to stay up late washing their clothes and making sure everything was ready. So I had to work overtime also in my home.
Normally, how long do women work in a maquila? En promedio, ¿cuánto tiempo se queda una trabajadora trabajando adentro de una maquila? ¿Un año, dos años, tres años?
Bueno, en el caso mío, yo en esta última empresa me he quedado 5 años porque el trato me ha tratado bien. En las otras empresas, no, en las otras empresas, 1 año, 1 año y medio, 2 años, así me ha dado, pero en esta última sí yo me he quedado 5 años.
In my personal history, this last factory that I worked in, I was there for 5 years, but that was because they treated me well. The other factories that I worked at, I was just there for 1 year or 2 years. I didn't stay long because they didn't treat me well.
O sea, Nicaragua is experimenting pretty significant growth in maquiladoras and tobacco plants, cigar production. Is that the future of Nicaragua, to be the cheap labor for the international economic system? Nicaragua está experimentando un crecimiento grande en las zonas francas y en las plantas, por ejemplo, de producción de tabaco en el norte del país. Entonces, ¿ese es el futuro de Nicaragua, ser fuente de mano de obra barata para el sistema internacional? Es la pregunta que estoy haciendo.
Sí, es el futuro de Nicaragua, como si usted le ve al futuro de Nicaragua, trabajar siempre como mano de obra barata de transnacionales.
No lo veo así. Lo que me gustaría y deseara que en toda la zona franca existiera un sindicato donde no fueran maltratados y sí que se pagara un salario justo. Pero como eso no se puede, entonces siempre uno tiene que trabajar así porque no se puede.
Yeah. No, I don't see that as the history, as the future. What I would love to see, what I hope to see is that every factory could have a union so that everyone would be treated well and also that they would have a better salary, a more just salary, and that would be the case in all of the workplaces in Nicaragua.
You've been listening to a Nicaraguan Maquila Free Trade Zone worker organizing a union. That does it for Labor Radio for this Monday evening and every Monday evening, 6 p.m. Tune in again. Thanks to Danielle, our engineer. This is the only show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington of, by, and for the working class. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio. To you.
Bring out your book.
Bring out your books.
KBOO's preparing for our legendary book and record sale.
We are accepting your donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, and VHS tapes. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit. KBOO, bring your donations to the stations at 20 Southeast 8th. Between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. weekdays.
Questions? Contact Ani by email at volunteer@kbu.org or by phone at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
If you have a larger donation,
call to arrange a pickup. The last day to donate is Tuesday, September 24th, so don't wait. Bring in those CDs, LPs, books, and DVDs right away. Thank you.
The time is 6:34, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. We just got done listening to Labor Radio, and coming up next is Prison Pipeline, and at 7 is Hard Knock Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is David Leslie, Executive Director of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. His organization is working to reduce the use of solitary confinement in Oregon prisons. So welcome, David.
Well, thank you very much for having me this evening.
So, David, tell a little bit about yourself and Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon.
Well, myself, I kind of feel like I'm an itinerant interfaith organizer. Somehow, back in the 80s, I was living in Texas and got working for an interfaith social justice group that was particularly working on human service type issues. And one of the issues that we worked on, kind of serendipitously, was on criminal justice reform in the Texas prison system. Now, you talk about some heavy lifting. That was pretty heavy lifting, but it was a great learning experience, particularly working on the death penalty and on issues that sometimes just were not in the mainstream public view. So my kind of journey has been professionally is working for interfaith and kind of ecumenical organizations, again, primarily on relationship building across religious spectrum, and then putting those relationships into what I would hope is good work on transformation in society on issues of social justice, peacemaking, economic equity. So that's a little bit of my own personal journey. Institutionally, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, we've been around for 40 years as an organization, predecessor groups almost a century in the state. Again, very similar type mission, working on issues of poverty, justice for farm workers, on the peace movement. I don't think there's an issue in Oregon that we have not touched or been touched by. And again, part of the method of our madness is this real call to unity that so often in our communities, we separate ourselves along every line I'm sure we could imagine tonight. And part of the idea is that no human beings, faith communities, at the essence, we all emanate from and return to the same place. So how do we find that sense or sometimes recapture that sense of unity and then put the good work, the spiritual energy, the assets to work for transformation in society?
Here in Prison Pipeline, we've done about three shows on the California prisoner hunger strike, and they suspended their hunger strike after 60 days. And one of the demands was to end indefinite solitary confinement in California prisons. Solitary confinement is also called super maximum housing, segregation, isolation, and more commonly, the hole. And it's designed to separate inmates and isolate them for a variety of reasons. And when we think of solitary confinement, we think of the worst of the worst. But it's not the most violent who end up in solitary confinement. It's often the most vulnerable, the mentally ill, immigrants, children, and LGBT inmates. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the United States holds over 80,000 people in some type of restricted housing. And prisoners in isolation are often confined to small cells without windows, with little or no access to the outside world or adequate programs and treatment, and inmates are confined to these cells for up to 23 hours a day. And such extreme isolation can have serious psychological effects on inmates and can lead to mental illness, self-mutilation, and suicide. Our listeners might be surprised to learn that the United States is a world leader in holding prisoners in prolonged solitary confinement, which the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights calls a form of torture. So, David, talk about your involvement in this issue of solitary confinement in Oregon prisons.
So getting to our Oregon story, if you don't mind, I want to tell you a little international tale, because there's no way we can get to our work here without kind of placing exactly what you've done, is putting what's happening in Oregon in a larger context. Right after Abu Ghraib hit the media and those just shocking photos, I think what happened to this country is that suddenly the practices that we might have said those people over there were in fact us here in this country. And I think it was a moment of, for some very deep soul searching about who we are as a nation, who we are as people, our policies and our practices. There was a professor at Princeton University, George Hunsinger, who was really moved by this and started a movement, well, an organization that really was a movement and is still a movement, to a force today called the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And this was a very interfaith gathering. And what happened was that people all over the country decided there was only one objective to be done: say no to torture. And in congregations and faith communities throughout the country, banners were hung on steeples and on sides of churches, teach-ins, etc. So that really started to focus the attention on the international and the U.S. practice in condoning torture, and including solitary and all the other things, waterboarding and other things that came to light. I think then it moved to Guantanamo Bay because that was a little closer to home, but was also a very visible example of torture practices. Now, both things that would be more physical, but also solitary confinement, keeping people in cells and heat, you know, isolated from one another. Well, as the logic, you see where I'm going with this. It didn't take very long to say, wonder what's happening in our own prison systems here in the United States. And I think this sense of being consistent and saying, you know, we talk about them, but why don't we look at us? And I think I use that to say then it started to come back into our states. So how were state correctional institutions living into this, local counties, even local communities? And here in Oregon, we, about a year and a half ago, set up a conversation with looking at the Oregon Department of Corrections, asking the very simple question. If solitary confinement and prolonged isolation is in fact a form of torture, are we doing this in Oregon Department of Correction facilities? And I think from a religious standpoint and kind of moral ethical people in general, is that we can say bad behavior. But I think more importantly, how do we get to best practices and best behavior? But to get there, oftentimes we have to name the bad behavior or inhumane practices that we had. So we put together a work group of religious folk coming from our network, people from ACLU, from Partners for Safety and Justice, organizations like the Disability Rights of Oregon, to kind of ask that question, what were we doing here in our state? We started a conversation with the Oregon Department of Corrections and said, are there behaviors and practices that we have here that have a detrimental impact on human beings in the correctional system? And would you be willing to go a journey with us in a way? Could we walk together to see how we might, in fact, create the best correctional system we can in this country? So in a way, it's a little lengthy travelogue, but that's how we kind of got to this issue, just knowing that there's been a fundamental discussion in the religious community for probably several centuries on what is the best way to deal with inmates, deal with correctional system. Is it retributive justice? Is it kind of rehabilitative justice? And so this one item fits into that much longer and deeper conversation.
So, David, talk more about that first meeting with ODOC. What were the findings? What were the results of that meeting?
We stepped back just a little bit. The first thing we really needed to do was some research. You gave some of the statistics that were very helpful. I mean, we had no idea how many people were in isolation or administrative segregation. We needed to kind of establish some benchmarks. We needed to know how long people were generally in that system. We needed to know administratively, how did that work? You know, if you got put in administrative segregation, for how long? So we had to do some of our own background work. I think the most significant piece that came out of the conversation, the two most significant pieces, was one, the I felt in the report's appreciation that there were those on the outside of the system looking in, raising the issue. There was no animosity. There was nothing pushing back that this is not appropriate. Sometimes we get that on other issues, maybe on this one down the road, but there was a genuine welcome to come and have the conversation. The second one was a commitment to meet again. We had a meeting scheduled for late 2012. Unfortunately, people were in and out. We had to table that meeting. Then the legislative session started. So simply put, things kind of collapsed there. So we're actually on path to have another meeting, we hope, before the end of the year to kind of pick up the conversation again. There's also going to be at Western University a conversation with crime victims and offenders and all kinds of people within the system. We also hope that that might be another platform, even though it may be a subset of the conversation, to continue to have that conversation. So I just think that that in the summary was, I think from some extent was the fact that this was pretty surprising that there are actually religious people who may not be directly involved that are interested. The second thing is, I think there is genuine interest in continuing the work together to hopefully get to that point where maybe the use of any type of form of prolonged isolation, solitary, might eventually be taken out of the practice of the system altogether. And of course, part of the issue for somebody like myself walking into a field like this, of which I'm not an expert, is again, trying to really listen carefully to language and definition. So you and I may have a very different definition of what prolonged solitary is about. I mean, some experts suggest anything over 5 days is prolonged solitary. Some would say 15 days. Anything beyond 30 days, I think you're starting to get a much more consensus point. So I think I know for the days going forward, we're going to have to really sit down and nail down what do we mean by the terms that we use. And then who do we go to say this is a valid, trusted outside entity that can kind of keep everybody in order when we want to apply our own standards and statistics.
So Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon has this listed as a public policy priority for the 2013-2014 legislative session. What are your goals?
I think we were really struck by Governor Kitzhaber's leadership in a significant place on criminal justice reform in Oregon, where he really announced before the session started that he had a commitment to building no new prison beds in Oregon, and that he really had laid out, starting to envision a different kind of system where much more attention was placed on how do we reduce recidivism? How do we get resources to people who need resources, for example, mental health, drug and alcohol addiction, other kind of mitigating problems that oftentimes lead somebody into a system but also can keep them in that loop and not break that cycle. So when we met with the chief of staff of the governor in January prior to the session, that really caught our attention. So that was just something we said, you know, as faith communities, I think it's important that we really start driving this into the pews of congregations. That's on the kind of macro level. I believe it was during the session, House Bill 3194, that then gave another level of kind of contextualization and maybe some real opportunity to put into place some of the things that the governor and others who have been on the reform front for probably decades in this state gave us another opportunity to some extent put our values into practice. So looking at things, particularly with juveniles, the way that some of the Measure 11 offenses, some of the sentencing guidelines, things on low-level drug convictions, you know, these were another way to kind of get at the issue. So as we were looking at that, and remember we have this work group that's just starting their work on the solitary confinement piece, we kept coming back to this issue about human beings as human beings. And in the preamble that you did for this interview, I think what we also have seen, and we've heard the testimony and read the materials, is that people who are in prolonged solitary there is such a dehumanizing effect of what that does to a human being, both psychologically and physically. And in our early discussions, and I think they were particularly helpful to hear the unfortunate narrative of what happens to people when they are put in prolonged solitary, separated from general population, very little impact or outreach or integration with any other human being other than the guard or the system person. And then they find themselves released back into society with no bridge into the larger community. And as we know, a number of people are people struggling with mental health issues, so you've exacerbated the problem. So like you said, it's not the worst of the worst. It could be a minor infraction. You're put in there. It may be somebody who already has, maybe they're angry. There's a lot of reasons or they're feeling at risk. That just gets heightened and the cycle just continues. And I think that as we continue to look at this from a human standpoint, that the reason why we feel like this is a legitimate place to continue to push and to put it in this larger reform is that it has, as we eliminate, I think, a positive impact on human beings. If we continue, it's going to have a continued negative impact on human beings. And I think, again, the studies sure clearly indicate that those who are in prolonged solitary have a higher risk just generally of recidivism, of repeating the cycle and being back in the system. You take then people that are already at risk for a lot of other factors, add solitary confinement. And I'm not a gambler, but I think we'll almost be at 100% that once released, there's going to be increasing problems in the day ahead. So that if we as a society, and if the reformers and the governor and the Department of Correction leadership is saying to us, you know, we want the best system possible, I don't see how we can go forward without having this as part of our agenda item. And I would say that you, as a faith community, maybe like community in general, I will make the apology that this has just not been number one on our docket. So part of what we're trying to find as an organization is how do we raise this higher level, knowing that our own process through that is probably something that's having to happen with a lot of Oregon society.
Will it now become a priority?
Well, I know in the hearts and minds of those who get captured by the stories, the narratives. A friend of mine was in San Francisco at kind of the height of the hunger strikes and very effective. There was a downtown in San Francisco, a rally in support of the hunger strikers. And she said they had built almost like a model solitary confinement cell so people could see what that's like. I don't see how after you have these experiences, you cannot make it a priority. Now, I think the question is for us in Oregon, we're fortunate in one way, we're not the worst of the worst states. There are states that are much more egregious in the use of solitary. Interesting, though, you can't make that general statement because there are some that are much better than Oregon. So what we're going to have to do, I think, clearly is have these kinds of conversations in pews and congregations and taverns and wherever people gather, because without it, it won't become a priority, if you follow my line of logic. So I think we're trying to figure out, and part of our fall planning right now is how to create a multi-year interfaith criminal justice reform campaign, which this will be part of the agenda item. Because I think with that kind of platform and with that kind of cross-sector kind of involvement, we then build a platform to be able to really move this deeper and farther afield in the state. One of the things that we did at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, which was kind of a journey for our board of directors, we actually had a board meeting in the penitentiary in Salem. We spent a whole day there, and we met with inmates. We had one-on-ones. We had group meetings to really hear their story and kind of what it's like, what their hopes and dreams, and what were some of the gaps between dreams and how do you get there. And then we actually had a board meeting. But I think the transformation of that was a powerful piece for the board of directors, because maybe someone had never been in the penitentiary. It's not an easy place to, you know, it's not on your tour stop necessarily. We also had a board member who son is in Salem in the penitentiary long term. And it was so affirmative for her because, as she would say, there's not a lot of place sometimes to tell the story about her son's incarceration and what happened. And I think by having a group of people be with her and, you know, just kind of walk with her really meant a lot. So to get to how we might transform and what we're trying to do is we really are looking at this kind of multi-level. Part of what we're really driving this on is an information campaign, because part of it is like the statistics, the things that you were sharing this evening, most people don't know that. So part of it's education. I mean, we've got to get the facts out to folks. The second thing, though, is increasing the contact with the system. The vast majority of people in the department get no visitors. There is actually a study out that suggests that an inmate who receives a visit, one visit, from a member of the clergy, regardless of whether that person has faith affiliation, whether that visitor is even of the person's faith, if he or she has faith, has a profound and positive impact on reducing recidivism, breaking down that isolation. So that's the second thing, is how do we get more good people of goodwill, not to convert, but to just be a friend, to just make that connection in the system. We think that that will have a positive effect. The third thing we want to keep working on, and this is kind of on our public policy agenda, is the reform. So things on trying to get to a point where Measure 11, the impacts of, you know, sentencing changes. I think just keeping the information, the pressure on the administrative rules of how segregation solitary works, keeping that as public as possible. And I think really for us, I think we framed the conversation. I think we just have to say we will have a Department of Corrections in Oregon, and it probably will be here for a while. So it's not going to go away anytime soon. If we are going to have it, how does it model best behavior? How do we have the most humane system? How do we have one that's driven on reconciliation, not on retribution? And I think that clearly this one aspect, this is just one aspect of that big picture, but it's paradigmatic. If we can do this well and better, I think it will have an impact on the whole system, because again, as you noted, this is probably one of the most dehumanizing aspects of criminal justice practices. So the flip side of the logic says, if we can make it go away or minimize, it actually heightens the humanization part. So I think this is kind of what we're driving on, and it's early stage of our kind of thinking and campaign development.
And I think it's great that you've partnered with Disability Rights of Oregon and Partnership for Safety and Justice and other organizations, and this is a huge and wonderful start to this campaign.
Well, we have to partner. I mean, I think that the expertise that is embedded in so many organizations, in families in Oregon, it's an ecumenical principle. There's much more we can do together than we can do apart. One of the things that we always do is extend a hand of invitation to anyone of goodwill that wants to kind of explore issues and join in on our work that we're about. It's very simple to get a hold of EMO. It's emoregon.org. And if you go to our website, it's very easy to make a general query. You can give us a call at 503-221-1054. And my personal email address is dleslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, at emoregon.org. You know, one place that I would recommend that listeners and folks go to is a very interesting article called Hellhole. It ran in the New Yorker in March 30th, 2009 by Atul Gawande. The reason that I lift that up this evening is the writing is so powerful in telling the stories of a few individuals who had been in situations of forced solitary. And as I read those stories and I read his writing, there were two things that struck me. His description of the cell as somebody was being put into a solitary supermax cell. And I literally got, I don't know what, you know, hairs on the back of my neck started to raise, my anxiety went up. And then he rolls out the narrative of these individuals. And these are people that are now in a position where they can tell a bit of their story. Long journey to get to that point. I think that Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, I'm so proud of this, is we really believe in the power of the first person and the commitment to first person narrative. Because so often the stories are filtered through lobbyists and corporate entities, people that have something to make off something. I know that going to a lot of these hearings. But I think it's hearing that story for the first time. And if faith communities can do anything constructive, it's opening their door and saying, hey, welcome. It's a safe place. We don't have to vote on anything today. We just want to affirm you and your story. And I think that on this issue, because it's not something, again, people easily come to. And as you read this article and people take the time to read the article, it's such a destructive piece of the soul. It's not just the psyche and the physical piece, but the soul. And rebuilding that is very difficult. And if you feel like you've been through that deconstructed and everybody's against you, to maybe have a hand open and saying, hey, just come on. We're interested in what we might do with this system. But to get there, we sure could hear somebody with some authentic authority. That seems to me to be a powerful act and a gift that could be done through the religious community.
And we will link Hell Hole to the KABU website also. David, I want to read some of the recommendations from the Vera Institute of Justice